Citizen Chef is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, everyone. You know, I can't believe it's already fall. And with the seasons change, we're also wrapping up season 2 of Citizen Chef. You know, it's been an exciting summer, and we've covered a lot of topics, and whether it is as foundational as how the USDA works, or as current and as exciting as the history-making increase in SNAP funding, as vital as recognizing the impact of Black restaurateurs and chefs, or as totally cool as considering the future of cannabis in our restaurants. And that obviously just scratched the surface, but I did want to close out the season by focusing again on the big picture. This year, we tried to make sure our conversations were wide-reaching, and while we always start with food, we definitely don't end there. What we eat affects our health, affects our environment, affects our economy, and has a history too that affects the way we understand ourselves and our country. But today, we're going to focus on the true cost of food. Now, just as an example, farmers in Iowa use tons of nitrates on their fields, and those nitrates leach out into the Mississippi, they head downstream, and they create a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And so what impact does the farmer in Iowa have on fishing communities in the Gulf? Does it have on fish reproduction in the Gulf and the effects that has on the overall economy? None of that is factored into the price of corn in Iowa or the price of soy in Iowa. So in fact, in July, the Rockefeller Foundation released a report that estimated that the true cost of food in the United States to be more than $3 trillion, as opposed to the $1 trillion that Americans spend. And that is because they factor in things like the environmental impacts and health impacts of our food habits, which cost us more in the long term. So we're closing out the season with a look at true cost accounting. And, you know, there's a growing movement to include true cost accounting, or TCA, when considering the cost of food, which can be far more than what you pay at the supermarket. And our guest today is quite familiar with that report and cited it in her article for Civil Eats entitled, Can Accounting for the True Cost of Food Change the Global Food System? So let me introduce journalist Lisa Held, who specializes in writing about food and agriculture and even hosts her own podcast called The Farm Report. So I'm thrilled to have Lisa on because she is an expert in the field, and she's also truly skilled at breaking down topics as big as TCA for us to understand. Lisa's going to help explain a bit more about what TCA is and how it impacts our current food system and how it could improve future systems in a way that is equitable and more sustainable. So welcome, Lisa.
Thanks for inviting me.
When I read the article that you wrote in Civil Eats, I was really intrigued because this is something that obviously is someone who's involved in the food system, not only participating in the food system, producing food, eating food, buying food for my home, but also very active in policy work around the food system. And so this is something that a lot of us have, you know, known for a while and talked about for a while. We all know that a poor diet can, you know, we're, I think, spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 billion a year in healthcare costs associated with poor diet. Who pays for that? And so when I read the article, I was like, finally, someone really, you know, putting some accounting practices around us so we can maybe figure out, you know, the impact, the actual financial impact that the way we're producing food has not only to our pockets, but also to the environment and to municipalities who are stuck holding the bill to clean this up.
I love that you brought up this idea that it's not really anything new, right? Like I talked to Lauren Baker, one of the editors of this book, True Cost Accounting, in my article about that fact, because she was talking about the fact that she had been asking these kinds of questions for her entire career, you know, maybe for decades, but there hadn't been a name for it or kind of a systemic way to think about this. So, you know, at its most basic level, true cost accounting involves measuring all of the impacts of a given food from production at the farm all the way through to consumption. And those would be impacts on people, society, the environment. And, you know, we've been doing that, but the idea here is we need an actual framework and a way to calculate those costs, each one, you know, come up with a number. Sometimes it's more qualitative because it can be tricky. Like when you think about how do you calculate something like animal welfare or equity. Sometimes it's tricky to come up with a number, you know?
So I'll just share with you very quickly a little story. Right out in front of my house here, there is a little triangle. And the triangle is a collection area for water as you get heavy rains. And then that is a little area that collects water before it goes into a pond. Now, this little pond that we have here, for the 20 years that I've been here, usually around July, there's algae blooms, it turns green, and it's kind of nasty. And of course, the reason this is happening is because there's potato farms all around here. They're dumping tons of nitrates on the farms. The runoff goes into the pond, algae bloom, right? And so the town engineer has got a grant from the state to spend about $50,000 to take this collection area and put a trap in it to collect water. But in doing that, you know, to cover his ass, he's got to put a 6-foot fence around it and cut down all the trees. And this is in front of my house. And so all the neighbors who live around here, we got together to go to an emergency meeting of the Parks Department, because the Parks Department has jurisdiction over this. And it was very much like Parks and Recreation. And at one point it came up, like, what role does the farmer play in this? And the answer was Clean Water Act, zero. He has no responsibility for cleaning this. And so I thought it'd be great to get you and on the podcast to talk about this idea of true cost accounting and who is going to bear the cost of a lot of these issues that we're talking about. So welcome aboard. So in large terms, so the viewers can understand, what is true cost accounting?
You know, the bigger idea is trying to come up with these frameworks that can allow us to make those calculations. And then the next step is how and where do we apply those calculations, you know, in order to either move policy or get corporations that are externalizing some of their costs to internalize them and actually pay, like, for instance, these farms you're talking about that are polluting the town, right? Like, you know, maybe they should, you know, be paying those costs of cleaning it up,
or have to create a collection area on their farm that will filter the water through, you know, bioswales and things like that before it goes into this pond or this other collection area. Sure.
Right.
Yeah. So give us an example. I think you cite following a tomato from Florida to Canada. Am I getting that right?
That was an example that Lauren had of research she had done in the past. Which is definitely something that kind of works. I think a better example that people might be able to kind of relate to is if you think about the cost of like a fast food value meal, right? It's super cheap. Like that's one of the amazing things about, that's like the selling point. It's like you can get this whole meal. It's really cheap. The price tag is low, right? But so then, you know, a true cost accounting analysis would look at things like, all right, what kind of pollution did the production of the meat cause, right? What were workers paid on the farms, in the slaughterhouse, in the restaurant? And not only what were they paid, but if they were paid low wages, how were they then accessing food? Were they getting SNAP benefits? That, you know, that's a cost, right?
What is in the cost of that Happy Meal? There is a cost associated of the, you know, it's dirt cheap.
Yes.
And you scratch your head going, how can they possibly do this? And so, but there are some of those are captured in the price of that, but obviously not
sure.
Not
well,
all of them.
Sure. The wages they're being paid are being captured in that price, right? So if a worker's being paid $11 an hour and then has to access SNAP benefits, for example, to feed their families, which, you know, is necessary, then that cost is not captured in there, which is a cost that, you know, taxpayers ultimately pay.
I'm glad you went there. That was exactly where I was hoping you were going with this. Because I wanted the listener here to really understand then the cost of cheap wages or low wages. Yes, it's going to keep food costs down, but somewhere along the line, someone's going to have to access some sort of benefits to actually feed their family. And so who's paying for that? Taxpayers are paying for that. And so essentially what we're doing, and this is, it's tricky though, because you don't want to raise the price of that meal, especially the Happy Meal. People on low income are that's what they're using to feed their family. And it's very inexpensive. And so raising the price of that would have adverse effects to that community. But on the same hand, if you paid those people more, they could probably afford the few dollars extra for the Happy Meal?
You know, that's actually probably one of the biggest things people ask me whenever I talk about, like, you know, producing better food, healthier food, you know, organic food, anything. It's always, well, what about people that can't afford it? Which is such an important question, right? And there's a need for people to simply get food on the table to feed their families. And I think you and I both agree on that, for sure.
Sure.
But, you know, I think true cost accounting can kind of help us untangle this, because the way that I think about it is the price of the food, if you think about it in a big picture sense, like the price of the food should be about what it costs to produce that food plus some sort of reasonable markup to pay the people who are providing it, right? The restaurant, the workers, the farmer. And then the other side, the question of who can afford that food is about food access. And that's about low wages, access to affordable healthcare, systemic inequality, wealth gap. So there are places that that side of things can be fixed, that can then enable people to access healthier food. And also, like, I mean, the labor question is crazy, because I mean, I think if you're talking about a small restaurant, this isn't true. And I think, you know, from operating restaurants, that labor costs are a very real, difficult thing for restaurant owners to deal with, right? And, but, you know, when you're talking about these big companies that pay insanely low wages and produce really cheap food, you know, I have this example that I would love to share.
Sure.
So there was a report that came out, Oxfam put it out last fall, 2020, that they did an analysis and they showed that Jeff Bezos could have personally paid each of Amazon's 876,000 employees a one-off $105,000 bonus with the wealth he accumulated between March and August 2020 alone and still be as wealthy as he was at the beginning of the pandemic. So that's the kind of money that exists within that system already. And so then, you know, a month later, the federal government put out a report showing that Amazon was among the top 25 employers with workers enrolled in SNAP in 6 out of 9 states. So literally taxpayers are making up the wages Amazon isn't paying while celebrating how cheap the groceries are, right? So there in that, like, there's a lot of examples like that where it is actually pretty straightforward and clear. And then there are other examples where it's not, and it is complicated, and you don't want to.
Right. And then he turns around and writes a $100 million check to World Central Kitchen to make it all better.
Right, exactly. Right. And it's like, well, that, which is good and great, and like they're doing amazing work, but it's also like these things can be fixed at the source, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so we talked about farmers and the farmers that are polluting, but what about large food companies that are just creating really unhealthy food at really low prices? And do you see them contributing to healthcare costs somehow? Where if you're going to produce food that is unhealthy, it's cheap, but yet we know it's harmful. Where are you on a soda tax? Is that, do you think that's a way to actually deal with this? With some, you know, some of the unhealthy choices, or do you prefer a carrot, you know, and like a double bucks program?
Right. Well, I'm a journalist, so I'm not going to like say what I think should be done, but I can.
You're a person,
but
too.
I can talk about the evidence that I cover.
Okay.
And you know, it's a really good question, because you know that Rockefeller report that just came out that showed the costs of the food system are about $3 trillion when you calculate in all the additional costs instead of the $1 trillion that we pay. The biggest external cost was healthcare, was the health impacts, right? So that was the biggest one, even above environmental and social. And you know, one of the questions that this book on TCA gets into is like, okay, so we know that we can calculate the health costs, and now who pays for it? Like, and how do you, like, and I don't know the answer. I mean, I think there's been some reporting on the soda tax, in California, around like how effective it's been. And I don't know off the top of my head, what that data looks like.
Yeah, on a larger scale in Mexico, they it seems to have lowered the obesity rates And now it's a total tax for the whole country. Mm. So it does seem to be working. You know, but again, soda is inexpensive, and people who are, you know, struggling to put food on a table, it is an option. And, you know, you also have the issue with you know, parents who are of low income and they're dealing with their families. They're telling their kids no all day long. You know, no to the you know, computer game, no to an iPhone, no to, you know, $100 pair of sneakers, no all the time. And so do you say no to a 89 cents, you know, half a gallon of soda? So at what point can you say yes? And so it becomes an issue because, again, it becomes a tax on poor people.
Right. Well, a big focus is in this book is on using these kinds of analyses to change policy. And so to shift the bigger system that, you know, rewards or disincentivizes certain practices, like all the way back at the source, so that it kind of starts to move big things that then change these prices altogether and the systems altogether.
Stick around for more with Lisa Held of Civil Eats. Hey, I'm Tom Colicchio, and you're listening to Citizen Chef. Let's get back to my discussion with Lisa Held of Civil Eats.
What can true cost accounting tell us about food production and climate change?
So some of the analyses that are in the book and also the Rockefeller Report did include greenhouse gas emissions as one of the externalities that can be calculated in this within the framework. So, you know, I suppose if you were going to look at a true cost accounting of, you know, a commodity steak or burger versus the equivalent amount of protein from, say, beans, and you calculated in the health impacts, the, you know, production, the and then the greenhouse gas emissions there, the price of the meat would be higher than, you know, the price of.
Would you calculate, so if you're looking at true cost accounting and how agriculture contributes to greenhouse gases, do you extrapolate out to the cost of storms? Because if our climate is warming up and it's creating more powerful storms, more destructive storms, do you calculate the cost of the cleanup of those storms then, and the damage to homes and businesses?
Yeah.
I mean, do you go that far?
I mean, you could. This is sort of an emerging field and discussion. And I think that you could make an argument that that should be included, right? You also, like, we haven't even talked about the flip side, which is incorporating the benefits that certain foods convey, right? And including that in the calculation. So, you know, you could have a farm that is doing something to, for instance, hold water on that farm in the event of a huge climate event, like a big flood, or, you know, and building resilience so that they'll be able to produce food when we're facing all this extreme weather. And so you could calculate in, you know, a benefit that they're providing as well. Or, you know, if they're building biodiversity on the farm that supports pollinators, and, you know, we're going to need pollinators because a lot of them are threatened. One of the challenges with true cost accounting is that it's this big, complicated, like, emerging academic discipline. And, like, this book it's very wonky. So, you know, it's hard to be like, yes, we can do it this way, or no, we can't do it that way. I think it's all kind of being worked out as we sit here.
Yeah, you know, I also, when I read the article, I started thinking about all the hog farmers in, like, North Carolina and the waste pits that are just, you know, creating communities that are unlivable because of the stench. Property values have dropped to nothing. You can't sell a house if you're located next to one of these hog farms. And yet that's certainly not calculated in the cost of pork at the supermarket.
That's, yeah, great example. And I think those environmental justice impacts are definitely a big part of the discussion here. And I mean, actually, one crazy thing is in North Carolina, where those hog farms are concentrated, In the last few years, there was a group of community residents that sued the industry and actually won and were granted some monetary compensation. And when you think about it, like this just occurred to me right now, that court was almost doing a form of true cost accounting, right? Because they looked at like the way these community residents had been affected their whole lives with, you know, health impacts from breathing in ammonia and the smells that ruined their quality of life. And like you said, value of their homes was destroyed. And the court said, you know, there's actually a calculation we can do to provide damages. And like, in a way, that's actually kind of a form of true cost accounting.
But again, did it change the practice? Are these companies willing to just dish out that money to keep the cost so low? So they're just selling more and more pork. And most of these companies aren't even owned by U.S. companies anymore. China owned Smithfield. So we're taking other countries just waste and decimating our communities because profit, because we want to sell cheap pork. We want to export cheap
pork. A lot of that pork goes to China too. Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sure. It doesn't stay here. Obviously I don't think anyone is suggesting that we should increase prices by, you know, 300% or 200%, whatever it would be to compensate. And so to what end are we doing? Is this strictly for if there is a lawsuit to calculate the costs? I mean, but where do you see this going? We talk about curating policy that could maybe stop some of this pollution at the source.
Yeah. So for instance, changing regulatory frameworks to say like actually the EPA right now is looking at changing regulations for slaughterhouses to if they had to figure out ways to pay for their own pollution into rivers instead of just being able to let it go and then, you know, the EPA is cleaning it up. That could be a way of making that company internalize that cost. There are some examples in the book in Denmark. They have done it in a way where they use taxes in interesting ways. So for instance, they tax the use of certain pesticides, certain very harmful pesticides. And that is a way to incentivize less pesticide use. And, you know, it's big policy at the federal level. And then for a good example, I think is like the Good Food Purchasing Program, which started in the Los Angeles public school system and is now in schools and other institutions around the country. And they're saying, okay, we're going to evaluate when we decide where we're sourcing our food from. It's not just going to be what's the lowest cost item. We're going to factor in all these other things. At the end of the day, they still have to consider the actual price tag, right? These are places using getting reimbursements for the federal government, which we know are low. But they are doing it, and they're considering all these different factors when they make decisions about the food that they source.
Certainly you could tie crop insurance to conservation. That's something that's been, you know, it's talked about for a while.
Yeah.
So all these farm subsidies are actually, you know, pegged towards conservation. Also, I imagine if there's higher costs associated with organic farming, and so they're not externalizing a lot of those costs are being captured in the price of organic food. Is there a way to create an insurance program for those specialty crop producers versus the subsidies that mostly go to corn and soy producers? But you know, at a certain point, I guess it does show you that a lot of what we're doing is completely unsustainable at any price. Again, the way we're producing corn and soy in places like Iowa are completely unsustainable. I mean, they're never going to clean up that dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And then what is the cost of that to the fisheries? What is the cost of that to just health? I mean, there are places now in Tampa, the algae blooms are just horrible, where people can't leave their homes. They can't go outside. They're getting respiratory illnesses. Fish are showing up dead. And so what is that doing to the fisheries there? What is it doing to our oceans? Who's going to bear the cost of that? I don't see the farmers in Iowa doing that. I don't know how much you'd have to charge them to do that, but it would be unsustainable for them as well. You kind of hope that at least through TCA, that the government, from a policy standpoint, could start looking at some of these practices and figuring out how to, again, either create better incentives for better practices, versus just fine people. But you can also come up with you know, clear rules around pollution, and can you at least find ways to divert, again, by using bioswales, by using other filtration methods to filter the nitrates at the source versus waiting for them to be discharged into the waters.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned crop insurance and thinking about this cropland in places that are emptying into the Gulf. You could also think about commodity programs in the Farm Bill. And I actually recently saw somebody showed me the actual calculation that happens to determine how much a farmer gets paid in forms of just a commodity payment, just for growing, just for having these acres of cotton or corn or soy. Right. And we're handing out all this money based on this simple calculation that only considers what is the market price of this crop right now, and how many acres do you have, and you know, I mean it's obviously far fetched. You and we know how policy works, but what if that calculation included, you know, you get less money if you're discharging nitrogen into the Gulf, or you get more money if you implement these controls to reduce the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that are coming off your fields, right? Like, you don't get you don't get a commodity payment if you don't plant cover crops. There's all these, you know, sort of things, that ways you could kind of go about it.
So how can TCA inform the consumer on making better choices in the marketplace?
The biggest thing is just kind of adjusting a consumer mindset. And I think, like, there's a really great chapter in the book that Kathleen Merrigan did that is just basically her talking about how to use true cost accounting to think about the impacts of plant and cell-based meats, these sort of faux meats that are emerging compared to actual meat. And it's a really cool, it's just an exercise. It's not academic like the others where she's like, we're going to do this study. She's just like, here's the questions that I would ask, you know, what is the actual nutrition of this burger? And, you know, where are the ingredients going to be grown, and how are they going to be grown? And so I think, like, for a consumer, it's like just familiarizing yourself with all of these questions so that when you do make decisions about what you're going to buy or what you're going to eat, you're able to think about it in this systemic way and kind of consider all these variables rather than just, you know, say, well, I heard plant-based food is better than meat, so I'm going to buy this Impossible Burger. Like, it's not that simple, unfortunately. And so I think just familiarizing yourself with the kinds of impacts that do exist can help consumers make better choices.
Stick around for more with Lisa Held of Civil Eats. Hey, I'm Tom Clickhue, and you're listening to Citizen Chef. I'm talking with journalist Lisa Held about reforming our food system using true cost accounting, or TCA.
In having this conversation, it's dawning on me that a lot of farms that are either organic or a lot of farms that are raising animals humanely, a lot of local farms that are around me out here, I'm out in the North Fork on Long Island, and wondering if they can use TCA to actually show the consumer why their cost of the food that you're buying in these small farms is more.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely something that we're going to be seeing more and more of. Chipotle had this thing that they released recently that was like an app where you could look at how your order fared on environmental and social like metrics, where it was like, okay, I ordered this bean burrito, and it was like you can see how many greenhouse gas emissions you saved and what the social impact was by choosing this ingredient. And so that's exactly what they're doing. They're using the way that they source as a marketing tool, essentially.
Right. So this dovetails right into environmental, social governance, you know, ESG, which is kind of a hot topic now. Investors are investing in everything ESG, are looking for an ESG play. Major companies, again, like Chipotle and other major food companies out there, are looking at how they could be more responsible to the environment, to social causes, and actually, you know, have better governance. And I'm imagining that, you know, that using you know, TCA could help those companies figure out where best to make those investments that will have a greater impact on the environment, our you know, social well-being.
Absolutely. Yeah. Lauren, the editor of the book who I interviewed, she pointed to investment as one of the most promising applications of TCA. And for that exact reason, that ESG has already kind of taken hold in the investment world. And so applying a TCA framework is not really new. It's just kind of an expansion of that ESG framework that already exists.
You know, you're going shopping. You're not really paying attention to this. You're loading up the grocery cart. What choices can you make? Now, I mean, obviously going to a farmer's market would be a better choice, especially for local economies. Going to a small farm and buying your chicken, all that's great. But most people shop in a supermarket. What can they do in the supermarket? Or do you think the supermarket then bears some responsibility to at least have marketing materials around better choices that are better for the environment and better for social issues? Who bears the responsibility to educate the consumer?
That is a big question. Journalists, maybe? I don't know. You know,
there's your next story.
I certainly feel the responsibility of educating very, very strongly. It weighs on me all the time. But
how responsible do you feel?
I feel extremely responsible. I would say educating the public is like maybe half, and then the other half is holding power to account. So that's a lot of what I do is reporting on the behavior of some of these companies, especially like the biggest meatpacking companies and that have a lot of power. But then educating people on is part of that, right? So it's kind of a combination. Mm-hmm. But it's, supermarkets are tough. Like I do think, you know, I have a lot of privilege in that I do shop mostly at markets. I also have a really great supermarket, by me that has really great options. Sure. Not everybody has that. I think like just shifting more to vegetables and grains and beans and all those foods, that immediately can have such a big impact, because commodity meats impacts in terms of all resources and also impacts on people. And they're just so outsized compared to all of the plant-based foods. Right. I do think that what the consumer can do is limited. By the time they get to the supermarket, it feels a little bit limited. And I think like, actually changing what is available in the supermarket is a better approach.
Right. What could be interesting is if the USDA created a framework and policy around labeling, where as part of labeling your product, you have to put the effect that this particular product has. Like, what are the external costs that are out there based on this particular item? So if it's a chicken producer, they're going to have to figure out the true cost accounting on that chicken, and that has to be part of the labeling. So at least the consumer understands, you know, where their choices are, you know, the choices they're making are contributing to, you know, these companies being able to externalize their costs. You know, even going as far as looking at wages and people who are relying on SNAP, who are working in particular meatpacking companies or large food companies. I mean, that could be an interesting way to go about it, just to have a framework to understand the contribution that you know, your purchase is making. Yeah, I would love to see a TCA accounting on the true cost of taking forage fish, and the calculation is, you know, 10 pounds of forage fish creates 1 pound of meat.
Yeah,
that doesn't seem to make sense to me at all.
It is getting better. It is,
but it's still.
I know.
It's just nonsensical to me, but. And what is the cost of that? What is the cost of a fishery collapsing because of this? What is the cost of the pollution of you know, these farm drift nets that are causing on the environment around these farms? And that would be an interesting exercise to look at.
Hopefully somebody listening that is a researcher will hurry up and do that for us.
Right. So different subject now. As a food journalist, what else right now are you looking at? What excites you? Do you see anything now in Tom Vilsack's second go around of the USDA that you think that we're getting right?
Oh, such a good question. I mean, the most interesting thing at the USDA right now, I think, is these what they're doing with meatpacking. And, you know, the Biden administration just had this big announcement that I covered in terms of how they're going to be tackling consolidation within the meatpacking industry and trying to implement some reforms that are a long time coming to shift the balance of power in the system towards farmers and workers and away from these big companies. And honestly, like, that even the administration putting out that executive order and showing the charts of how, you know, profits have risen and prices to farmers have not, and that kind of stuff was so taboo to talk about like forever. And so that was a little, I was really surprised by that. And
one of my food heroes, Shelley Pingree, has been really focused on the licenses, the 25 licenses that are giving out by the USDA to various farmers and meatpacking, and how the largest of the companies make sure that these licenses aren't getting put out there at all. And so it's really restrictive for a small farmer, where they can only, you know, maybe they can kill the animal on the farm, but they can't break it up into pieces, so they can't sell into the supermarket chains. They can only sell on their farms or farmers markets. Highly, highly restrictive. And it's the big meatpacking companies of the world that make sure that these licenses don't get out there. And so she's been doing some great work on that.
Yeah. Shelley's great. I've interviewed her many times. She always has a lot of insights on these topics. And the flip side of what USDA is doing is they are also putting money into building up regional meat infrastructure, which, you know, is speaks to what you're talking about. You know, there's an issue with access to slaughterhouses if you are a small farm raising animals on pasture, and there's all these rules about where you can sell, and there is some movement and energy around tackling that and making it easier and building up more resilient infrastructure for regional and smaller systems. That's I think the most interesting thing coming out of USDA. And looking at some of the climate solutions that are being proposed for the food system and whether or not they are really effective and if they come with unintended consequences. So I think there's a lot in that area that is going to be really important, obviously, as we're facing this climate crisis. And things are pretty urgent on that front.
Lisa, listen, it's been great having you. And I you know, hopefully we can keep this communication going, because you're a wealth of information. You're working a lot of things that interest me. Thanks for joining us today. And thanks for the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. I'll come back anytime.
TCA, or true cost accounting, feels intuitive to me. And I think we can all use a more inclusive lens when it comes to assessing the impact of our actions, and not just when it comes to food. That being said, I hope this conversation, along with the previous episodes, inspire you to think of the larger picture when choosing your groceries or going out to dinner. You know, we all have to eat, but whether our foods enrich our lives or cause more harm is up to us. And I have a lot of faith it'll be more of the former. I've learned so much this season, and I hope you have too. Let us know what stuck with you. And if you have a chance, whether it be on Twitter or #CitizenChef or in a review, what kind of world do you want to see, and how can you help get us there? Thanks again to journalist Lisa Held for her expertise and her excellent reporting on all things food. Thanks to A Place at the Table, and thanks to you for listening. Now, we hope you've enjoyed this season of Citizen Chef, and you have a safe, happy, and more importantly, delicious autumn. Citizen Chef is executive produced by Christopher Hasiotis, produced by Gabrielle Collins, and researched by Lillian Holman. Citizen Chef is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like this, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere you get your favorite shows.